Accession number 7325, reel 2.
Colonel Legg, reel 2. Was there any sign of the Italians having been in occupation in Castellar?
Virtually none. They withdrew in their own time, so they hadn't abandoned equipment or anything like that.
What happened next?
Well, then, within 2 days, we were told to move into Eritrea to a little township called Sabderat. That was on the 19th of January. And for that move, we actually marched from Castle of the Sabderat, which is about 20 miles. So the actual training that we'd done at Gdaref in marching stood us in good stead then.
Did anybody fall out?
Well, you always get some falling out, but in fact, very few.
What did you find when you got to Sabderat?
Again, nothing. The Italians had withdrawn. It was a very small, rarely a native village, hardly a town at all.
No cantonment or fort or anything?
No.
Had you come across any Italian resistance so far?
None at all, no.
Had you seen their air force?
No, not even their air force.
Was there any air force on the Allied side?
Yes, there was, but again, we didn't see it operating because we rarely went in the front line. We were merely following up the Italians as they withdrew, and there were British forces, or when I say British forces, British colonial forces in front of us all the time. There was a screen.
So what happened next?
Well, then we moved forward to the Agordat area, which is really the first big town you come to in Eritrea once you start going eastwards towards Keren. Now that must have taken about 7 or 8 days, because we sometimes marched, we sometimes moved forward by transport in sort of starts and jerks like that, until we got into the Agordat area. And then we seemed to be sort of moving round Agordat a good bit, for reasons which we didn't understand at all. I, in fact, didn't keep a diary then, because we were not supposed to, but I remember noting down at that time, and I'm afraid I haven't got it now, how we moved. Now, I remember we moved virtually every day between the time we left Sabderat till we got into the Agordat area.
About how many miles a day would be your normal journey?
It's very difficult to answer that, because you can't judge that when you're sitting in transport, because it's a question of what the road's like and how fast they can go. And again, I can't remember offhand how far the distance is between the frontier, that is the Eritrean frontier with the Sudan, and Agordat. But I just can't answer that. We must have done at least 20 miles a day, I should think. But it wasn't all necessarily straight.
And what happened next?
Well, when we got to the Agordat area, we began to come quite close to where the enemy were for the first time. And occasionally we used to see enemy aircraft coming over. And eventually, by, as I say, a succession of moves, we eventually got into what afterwards came to known to me as what is known as a forming up place for an attack. But again, I must emphasize the point that we never knew really what the plan was or what we really intended to do at any time the whole way through this campaign, except when it was painfully obvious, like outside Keren. We obviously had to capture Keren. So we eventually, by maneuvering a good bit round Agordat, it must have been about the 30th of January, we arrived in what was really an assembly area. I won't call it a forming up place. It was an assembly area for an attack on the town. And I remember that particularly because it wasn't a very good place, because it was in range of the Italian artillery. And I think they'd brought up some big guns. The rumour was they'd brought up some naval guns from the port of Massawa. And as a result, you got these shells landing on us as we were in this area. So we moved a little bit back from there to in order to avoid unnecessary casualties. And then during that day, which was, I'm sure, was the 30th, the day of January, because the actual battle took place on the 31st, it was the day before, the battalion was asked to send out two patrols on our front. If I can explain that our assembly area was in a valley, and there was mountainous country on both sides, particularly on our right side. We were in the plain. And the idea was to send out patrols in this plain and see where the enemy was, if he was there at all, in front of the town of Agadir. One of those patrols came from my company. And we sent out this young officer and his platoon. And he must have been out for many hours, most of the afternoon into the evening. And eventually came back, having sent a series of messages back to me, which were saying what he'd seen and done, which were relayed to my CO, who then passed that back to brigade and further back. The other patrol, and again I'm speaking of hearsay now in the sense that I never actually saw this happen, but that went astray and never produced any information whatever. But the patrol that came from my company, in fact, did very well, and the officer eventually got an MC for that. Now, it was on the information that this patrol produced, so far as my own brigade front was concerned, that the general commanding 4th Indian Division decided to attack. I mean, he may already, I can't say what his overall plans were, but he may have already decided to attack along the mountains on our right. But I remember that it was my CO who said, oh, the general said that was just the information he wanted to know what to do. And so that night, the commanding officer got his orders for an attack the following morning.
When you sent out the reconnaissance patrols, what instructions did you give them?
What I said was that we believed that the enemy was holding the ground between the two main features on our right and left flanks, which must have been a distance of about a mile and a half, I should think, the valley was broad, perhaps 2 miles broad. We really wanted to know where they were and what strength. And that's what that information was brought back by this patrol.
Can you remember which your company was, by the way?
Yes, it was A Company.
And what instructions did you give them about getting involved with the enemy?
Well, of course, we were fully on active service then, and therefore the whole question of ammunition and arms equipment was all taken care of. They were all ready all the time. It was just a question of getting the orders to take part in an operation, and we got those that night. And then, having got those orders, I then gave my orders to the platoon commanders, and they then gave their orders to their sections. And that was probably just as it was getting dark.
But were they under instructions not to open fire on the enemy?
No, not at all. They were told, they were just given the instruction to go and capture the enemy positions.
What happened next?
Well, if I could now give a very short resume of what was the battalion plan. The plan was that the battalion should move forward from its assembly area to a forming up place, which was really the place, as the name implies, where you would change from a normal moving formation into the battle formations that you were going to use for the attack. The actual plan for this was that we would advance in a column through the night in the order C Company, B Company, A Company, and then in reserve D Company. They would then reach a point on the right-hand end of the forming up place, which is an imaginary line, and the leading company would wheel left and go for a certain distance down it, followed by B Company, first of all C Company, then B Company, finally A Company, so that having wheeled left and then turned right again to face the enemy, we got three companies forward and one company, D Company, in reserve. Now, we were told that this particular attack would be supported by tanks. And when I say tanks, that meant the infantry tank, the I tank, which had been the battle winner at the Battle of Sidi Barani, because there was no known weapon, no known gun, rather, in the whole of the Middle East that the enemy had that could knock out an I tank. So far as the Italians were concerned, if they thought they were in the battle, their morale went down very low. So that was the plan for forming up the battalion, and the tanks were to form up in front of us between the forming up place and what is known as the start line. The start line, again, is an imaginary line. It's sometimes taped, but in this case it was an imaginary line between two features. And it's merely there to make certain that all units who are taking part in the attack actually start the battle at the same time. It's as simple as that.
What happened next?
Well, those were the orders given out by my commanding officer. And we then rested till about, I think, midnight. And then we formed up as a company behind B Company. And again, they were behind C Company. And we moved forward in the dark to the forming up place. The battalion headquarters having arranged guides and people to mark the spots so we wouldn't go astray. Well, like all advances at night, particularly in column, of course, it took hours because we were constantly sort of concertinaing. Although we were walking, and it's not like being in a traffic jam. As you know, when you're driving your car and the speed varies, you concertina each other and you get movements forward very fast, and you get quite a long time sitting absolutely still waiting and wondering what the hell was going on. And this, in fact, meant that we took all the rest of the hours of darkness to get to the forming up place. And my company, the right-hand company, A Company, didn't arrive in the forming up place until it was 5 minutes before we were supposed to leave the forming up place to reach the start line. The other point was that in my company was the one and only officer and platoon who knew where the enemy were. And I'd made them the right-hand forward platoon, and they were going to be the guide platoon to get the whole battalion across this valley to the enemy position. But as I say, when we reached the forming up place, we had 5 minutes to go, and it was just getting light. And I looked away to my left flank to see B Company. It was forming up properly because they were, and beyond them, C Company were attacking. I couldn't see them anywhere in the morning, the half light. And I then went to the commanding officer who was standing with his sort of tactical headquarters at the right-hand end of the forming up place to ask him what I should do, whether I should wait for B Company to get in position and make contact with me. However, he then said to me, look, you have 5 minutes to go. And I took that to mean that I wasn't to stay there 1 second after the correct time. Well, then we reached the moment when we had to leave the forming up place. And we'd already, by that time, formed up into a battle formation. And I gave the order to advance. And as I was peering through the first line, I was looking for the tanks all the time. I couldn't see the tanks at all. So I thought, oh, well, they can't have waited for us. They must have gone on. And so we reached the start line. And if I can digress here, when my regiment took part in the Battle of Sidi Barrani, they also attacked with infantry tanks. Unfortunately, the coordination between the tanks and the infantry wasn't very good because the tanks had already taken part in another attack and they'd been moved across to our particular front. And the timing was extremely complicated. It was nobody's fault. But the fact remains that the tanks got too far in front of the infantry. And when they overran the Italian lines, the Italians bobbed up and inflicted quite heavy casualties on my regiment. And this was a lesson we all knew. So when I got to the start line at Agadir and could see no tanks, I remember saying to my platoon commanders, they've gone ahead of us again. We must get a move on. Because I couldn't see B Company and I couldn't see C Company at all. I couldn't wait for them. We then advanced across, I suppose, about 700 or 800 yards of fairly open country, and it became apparent that we were being shot at. You know, it's not always very easy to know you're being shot at because there was a barrage of guns, and of course there was a most immense noise on our right flank because there was another attack going along the mountains on our right. However, I began to realize pretty soon that we were being shot at because we were having casualties. And as we advanced as rapidly as we could across this open country, it dawned on me and everybody else in the company that the tanks weren't there at all. They were behind us. However, there was nothing for it. We had to go on. And eventually I said to this officer, a chap called Adams, who had been on this patrol, I said, please point out this feature where the enemy are, you see. And he'd already made clear to all of us that there was a very pronounced rock sticking up from the plain and that they were there. And eventually he said, there it is, you see. So as soon as we saw that rock, I told the whole town, the whole company, that we got to do a bayonet charge. And we then charged this and captured the rock. And it then became obvious to us that, in fact, the enemy weren't holding the rock, that their positions were behind the rock, I mean, 100 yards, a couple of hundred yards back, where there was a whole system of trenches. So I thought, we can't stop here. So we drove on then, coming in at a slight angle, so that we weren't absolutely coming square to trenches. We were sort of rolling them up from the side. And to cut a long story short, we actually went forward and captured a slice of about a couple of hundred yards of enemy trenches, with trenches on either side. We just gripped it like that, with no sign of anybody else at all. And I remember particularly then, at that particular moment, and this brings out this point of communication, it was the first moment when I could have had a chance to communicate with my commanding officer, saying, look, we're here by ourselves, and there's nobody else in this attack. I can't see B Company, I can't see C Company. There's no tanks. We can't stay here forever without very considerable casualties. Somebody's got to reinforce us. However, at the moment I got this off, the tanks arrived. And, of course, as soon as they did that, they went straight through us. And there were only three of them, I admit. But the effect on the Italians was that they either surrendered or up sticks and ran away.
How many tanks altogether were there in the attack?
Only three, which sounds very little, but the morale effect of that on us and the alluring morale effect on the Italians was terrific.
Can you describe the bayonet charge in a bit more detail?
Well, yes and no. It's not very often in the last war that people did take part in a bayonet charge, but the fact is that when we were advancing, we were spent the first phase of the period between crossing the start line and reaching this rock in what I call a fairly tight formation. That is, the platoons are widely dispersed. The men advancing, they'd already fixed their bayonets, of course, before the attack started. It was a high port. And myself and my little company quarters in the middle, with two platoons forward and one platoon in rear. Each section in a section column. And as soon as we started having having casualties, I then waved them to disperse. That is, that they should each section should disperse laterally, so they would be less of a target from someone firing from the front. I didn't do that at the last moment because of difficulty of control after that. And then, as soon as we got within, say, 100 yards of this, what we thought was the enemy position, I gave the order to charge, and we all ran forward together. But, of course, from the point of view of an officer, it was quite ridiculous, because all I had was a pistol, which is very difficult to hit anything with, even if you're standing still. So all I did was run, and left it to the men. But there was never time to put down a Bren gun and give supporting fire. We simply had to go and get their position.
Were the men screaming as they charged?
Oh, yes, they did, yes.
Effectively?
Very effectively, yes.
What did they scream out?
Well, they just sort of... I can remember what they actually shouted, but there was a sort of... a roar went up as they went in.
And once you reached the rock and saw that you had a further objective beyond...
Yes.
Were you then under fire?
Oh, very much so. We were under fire all the way up from about halfway between the starting point, the start line and the rock, and very gradually it increased as we got near this rock. And then we thought we could get this position. That would ease things a bit. But of course we in fact ran into an absolute hailstorm of this. But may I say straight away, unless you think this is a very big operation, that the troops facing us were Italian colonial troops. They were Eritreans with Italian officers. And I don't think their marksmanship was all that much because there was a terrific blaze of fire. But they didn't really hit an awful lot. So, I mean, I think our casualties were, I think we had about 8 killed, but not very much. I mean, it wasn't anything like you'd expect in a sort of First World War attack or anything like that.
And as you neared the trenches, what happened to the troops? Did they flee or stand?
They stayed in the trenches, and we overran them. And in fact, they were either wounded or killed in the particular sector of trenches that we captured.
What were the orders about prisoners?
Well, the orders were that if there were prisoners, we should send them back at once. And in fact, we captured two white Italian officers, and there were a certain number of Eritrean soldiers who we captured, and they were sent back by, as soon as we could arrange this, by an escort from my reserve platoon. But of course that didn't happen until we'd been reinforced by the tanks and the rest of the battalion arrived on our flank.
How much tenacity did the Eritreans show?
Quite a lot until the moment when the tanks arrived. I think they were quite prepared to go on firing right up to the moment that we carried out our rifle company attack. But once those tanks arrived, that was hopeless, and they all ran away into the bush or withdrew or surrendered.
How many casualties did they seem to take in terms of dead and wounded?
Well, it's very difficult to say, because I don't remember actually counting, but about 2 or 3 days after, I think it was 2 days after battle, we had to do a thing which was one of the most unpleasant things I've done in war, and that is clear up that particular battlefield and go and collect all the bodies. And I remember there seemed to be quite a large number of bodies, but I just don't know how many they had killed there.
What did you do with the bodies exactly?
Well, the as far as I remember, the actual Eritrean bodies were buried in situ. All the bodies of the Royal Fusiliers were collected, and then pioneer platoon of my battalion, they made a communal grave just outside Agordat and covered it with rocks and put up a cross with all the names on, and that I presumably was notified ultimately to the War Graves Commission so that those bodies could be exhumed and reburied in a central cemetery.
The Eritreans were put in a communal grave, were they?
I don't remember. My feeling was that they were just buried where we found them.
What were the conditions of the bodies after 2 days?
Oh, terrible. Within 24 hours, a body in that climate blows up like a balloon, and if you're white, you go black. So that you, it's the most disgusting sight, and the smell was simply dreadful. That was the worst thing, from the morale point of view of my battalion, it was the worst thing they could have done. I mean, it's bad enough burying the enemy, but to have to pick up the bodies of one's own soldiers that you'd know in that condition and put them into transport and then move them to some central grave was a disgusting experience.
Could it have been done any other way?
Well, my own view is that somebody obviously has got to clear up the battlefield. That means collecting the dead and also, to a certain extent, to retrieving lost weapons and that sort of thing. But as far as possible, a regiment should never have to clear up its own battlefield. It should do somebody else's. It would be much better to have done that.
Because of knowing the individual.
Knowing the individuals and seeing the state they got into.
Were there vultures and things around?
Oh, yes, yes. And of course, they were almost immediately after battle, the day after. Well, I think it was the day after we went back, maybe the day after. There was a large number of locals who came out to do a bit of looting. They were all moving around, seeing what they could find. They weren't after bodies, but they were after, I don't think they were even after weapons, but they were after anything else they could pinch.
What was your policy towards them?
Oh, drive them off.
Did they go willingly?
I think they did after you sort of threatened to shoot them, if I can call that willingly.
What's happened next?
Well, then we moved forward from there to the Keren area. I think the point I should make now is that it was rather like the move from Sabderet to Agadet. It was a move fits and starts. And we must have arrived in the Keren area about the 2nd or 3rd of February. That's about 3 or 4 days after, maybe a little bit later than that, 3 or 4 days after Agadet. And almost immediately, we relieved the 2nd Battalion of the Cameron Highlanders on a feature that became fairly famous, known as Cameron Ridge. This was to relieve the Camerons, who had already taken part in the early operations at Keren. If I could say a few words now about the sort of geography of that area, the fact is that there is a mountain range that runs north-south, and dividing Keren and the sort of plateau beyond Keren that stretches across Eritrea, dividing that from the western area from which we'd come. And the entrance to Keren, that is the town of Keren, was through a gorge, so it was a natural defensive position. Now, we were concerned with the features on the left of Keren, that is, the left side of this mountain range, as opposed to those mountains on the right side of the road running into Keren. They are very steep, they are very barren, and extremely difficult to operate over. The feature that we were asked to defend, having relieved the Camerons, was known as Cameron Ridge, was about 2,000 feet above the plain and very steep. Halfway up it, there was a railway line that ran along the side of the of this ridge and eventually went through a tunnel around the right-hand end of it and then down towards the gorge and into Keren. Beyond Cameron Ridge were two immense